This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak radio show. Here, when the people speak, we make a difference. Tonight, the people speak with Kathleen Berry, feminist, activist, and author of Unmaking War and Remaking Men. We will be discussing the social forces at work in the military indoctrination process, how replacing the self and notions of morality with a buddy system of unrelenting devotion to comrades engenders disregard for human life and guarantees atrocities against enemies seen as subhuman, the artificial social construct of masculinity used as a guarantor of patriarchy and military service, and why a purely defensive military used as a global peacekeeping force, both possible and desirable. Is it really possible? I know it's desirable, Kathleen, but is it possible?
Thanks for the question and for the lead-in on this. I speak about a global peacemaking military in this book, and it's premised on the idea that we would work toward the demilitarization of all nation states. And yet we cannot do completely without a military in the world, and Gaddafi in Libya is a very good example of why we need to have a force, not particularly the United States, which has interests beyond humanitarian that are detrimental to these kind of missions. But we have already a number of states in the world that have demilitarized, that have no army, no military at all, Costa Rica being the strongest example of that. And it's gone on since the mid-1940s, as a demilitarized state, and still is. So it's not unrealistic. Costa Rica is not backed by the United States. It's not backed by any other military, and there are other states like this. If we put our focus on our long-term strategy of demilitarizing nation states, then our short-term strategies would be much clearer and much more directed and focused in that direction. Then we would understand why there's such a dilemma for people right now about the United States holding this no-fly zone over Libya.
Well, exactly, Kathleen. I was gonna say, in light of the world events, and it seems that we're becoming more closely aligned with war and with warriors. You know, when we talk about war, the warriors are our sons and daughters.
That's right.
And that, I think, puts on such a dynamic where you're sending your children off to war, and then you want them to come back alive, but you want them to kill other people and their children. It's insanity,
and you expect them. You expect them to kill other people and their children, and then come back home and 2 weeks later not be violent people. It's impossible, considering the brainwashing that the U.S. military puts them through. So we see, I think we can attribute a lot of the violence in this country to the fact that we've been at war for a decade now. And it's constant recycling of human beings.
Well, look at the army specialist Jeremy Morlock. I'm sure you've read about him or heard about him. is one of five soldiers facing court-martial on charges of premeditated murder stemming from the deaths of three Afghan villagers. Is this kind of, it was plain outright murder. It was killing for sport, according to Jeremy Morlock's lawyer. And is this unusual in war?
The only reason that there's a trial going on is because there was some kind of documentation of it happening. It is a daily occurrence in war. It is expected by the commanders of their soldiers. It is how the soldiers are trained from basic training on to look at the enemy being anybody who is not them, the soldiers. And so killing for sport, killing out of fear, killing, making a game of it, it's the nature of war now. And I don't mean nature as in it's inevitable. Or natural, not at all. I mean, it is the way the U.S. military conceptualizes war and then literally brainwashes human beings to turn them into killers, which it takes an awful lot of work because as humans, we are resistant to killing other human beings.
Kathleen, you have written in your book, and if I may read a paragraph from your book, patriotism evokes a sense of belonging and in exchange demands our loyalty to our state, patriotic devotion to one's land and allegiance to one's state, as if one's family yields in a country's people a cohesive identity against the outside world and the other is the enemy. Its model and origin is the patriarchal family, male-dominated, violence-prone, and close to the world outside of itself. But it is not an even exchange because patriots are expected to put the interests of their state above even their own lives, the ideology that relies on men's expendable lives for war. That's so powerful. And tell us how you think patriotism has run amok in our country today.
Well, you know, of course, when we entered into the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, George Bush and his minimalist but black and white thinking laid out the ground rules. You're with us or you're against us. And then that was reinforced by the media as anybody who wasn't for the war from the very, very beginning was considered, you know, like a traitor. It's an in-group thing that patriotism is based on. In the same way that when families turn inward on themselves, it's usually because they're closing off from the outside world because heinous things are going on in the family. Childhood abuse, domestic violence against women, numbers of things are going on that cause families to turn in. The same thing with the country then. It turns in on itself. If we expect our soldiers to see Iraqis, Afghans, Pakistanis, and now Libyans as the enemy, patriotism in this country requires that we back home also see them as the enemy. And so we have this tremendous anti-Islamic force within the United States, these disgraceful hearings in Congress a couple of weeks ago.
About unbelievable.
About Muslim extremists. as if Christians haven't been extremists in you know, murdering abortion doctors, shooting down people in Tucson, trying to kill Congresswoman Giffords. That's what we bring back home. This anti-Islamic, anti-Arab racism in this country that is really accelerated is our bonding with our soldiers in combat zones. I mean, that's how it plays out, because that's the way they are trained to go into combat zones. One mm-hmm. of the points that I make and try to be very clear about in this war, in this book, is that racism, in this case, anti-Islamic, anti-Arab racism, is indigenous to war. It's the way war is made, by turning whole groups of human beings into the other, and thus being able to more easily kill them.
Well, the other being the evil other. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that we desire to see the other as an evil entity, because evil, if you extinguish evil, if you kill evil, it's okay. It is an acceptable thing to do, because after all, they're evil.
And it also is based on cultivating fear, just as families who close off from the world, keeping their secrets within them, create a fear among the family members of the world outside. That world outside is that dangerous, hostile place. Those other people are dangerous, or we should be suspicious of them or worried about them. It goes right from the family to the war zone. In terms of the vast dimensions of our society that it covers.
You consider this a brainwashing, the training process, the basic training. That's an interesting term, just saying it out loud right now, the basic training of a killer.
Right.
That is so, it almost hurts to say those words. But it is an insidious brainwashing, and it's necessary to turn ordinary, young people that probably had a hard time being grounded, for the weekend, to turn them into killers. And that's exactly what they're turning them into.
Right. And it's, you know, and I think it's important to point out that a lot of these young people going into the military are completely unaware of what is going to happen to them.
Yeah.
The recruiters consistently, persistently lie, both in their printed and media advertising, and when they're talking to young people coming in to their offices. And they lie about what the Army and the Marines are going to provide for them. They think that they're going to get a college education. They think they're going to get $40,000, these huge signs outside of recruiters' offices. But and that's bad enough. That's real deception. But what's worse than that is that they don't know the extent to which they are going to be dehumanized by the military for the purposes of making killers and turning them into killers. I think very few of them have a sense of what's going to happen. I remember listening to one soldier who quickly became a conscientious objector during basic training, when he went in right after the 9/11 attack and the United States and went in for what would be really positive reasons out of concern for his country and for his people's welfare, but really against his mother's wishes, he pointed out. And once he got on the shooting range, it was being taught not only how to use a weapon, but really being hyped up to kill. At one point, it occurred to him that the object on the shooting range was so far away that he could not make out what it was.
But he shot
it. It was at that moment that he said to himself, my God, that could be a woman or a child. And he, you know, that is really anti-brainwashing. You think something like that, you engage your own empathy, and it becomes really much more difficult to brainwash you. And so the military does everything in its power to keep the soldiers from going to that place of empathy that all human beings have in them, because as soon as they do, they've lost them as killers. And that's what happened to this young man.
You talk about muscle memory in the book. And it says here, journalist Thomas Ricks quotes a Marine Corps drill sergeant, an M16 can blow someone's head off at 500 meters, he teaches. That's a beautiful thing, isn't it? And the Marines make his sense of beauty their own by a resounding yes, sirs. One soldier pointed out that it becomes muscle memory and adds, you don't think about it, you just do it.
Yeah. That's the success of brainwashing. The point of brainwashing is to take away the thinking process so that you're simply reacting. You get into a combat zone and you see a woman coming toward you with a bag, and the first thing you think of is it could have a bomb in it. Because she's not an American. She's not, you know, a military person. She's not one of your buddies. And so you blow her to pieces. I mean, this actually happened. And you find out it was groceries in her bag.
Yeah. It happens all the time.
And the point is that you don't think about it. You know, you'll think about it.
David Grossman calls it killology. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
Right.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But he talks about there being a physiological, change that happens when fear takes over the mind, that the frontal lobe shuts down and you become an automatic weapon based on whatever you're used to doing. And if you're used to having a gun and shooting, you point and shoot and you don't think.
Yeah.
You can't think at that point.
Yeah, yeah, you're running really heavily on adrenaline. And so it's a behavioral conditioning. It's the same kind of conditioning that, was done to, you know, to rats to get them to respond when the bell rang, in the cage. It respond behaviorally by excluding the thinking process. Now, that is a tremendous dehumanization of the soldier. We know that even worse than that is that it's going to lead to the murder of other human beings. But the soldier himself or herself is dehumanized in that very training. And back to what we started talking about in the beginning of the program, with a global peacemaking military, you would not use that kind of training. The training would be based on protecting the human rights of all peoples. And that would be the focus, which I think the U.S. military would call, very wimpy. But you can rely on people being very strong and very protective in very dangerous situations. We see this in the way firemen and firewomen in the fire departments are trained. You know, they're trained to go into very, very dangerous situations, be very, very strong and help and powerful, but always for the purpose of saving and protecting human life. We know it can be done. It just simply, the U.S. military has chosen this other path.
Well, I think that, and I think this is one of the things that you talk about is the psychopathic leadership versus this ideology of empathy that could train our soldiers to take a different path, but they're not. So who's, now what do we do here? Do we blame the soldier? Do we say you should have known, you could have known, you could have changed it? Do we lay blame at the feet of our psychopathic leaders, such as George W. Bush, Ariel Sharon, Osama bin Laden, these people that make war their livelihood? Who do we blame, and how do we get them to change, Kathleen?
You know, psychopaths are very much not given to change. So
no.
We need a massive change at throughout the whole society. So I'd like to take it from a different direction, dealing precisely with your question. But let's come back and look at how we're socializing men in particular, with the expectation, men growing up, boys growing up to become men with the expectation that they will become killers. Or that they will be killed at a very young age. That's something that female socialization generally does not include. We're more focused on that, you know, young girls will grow up and become mothers and servants of men. But boys are growing up learning that they very likely could be called upon to defend their country or their village or their community or their family, and there's a possibility in that they could be killed. That's really heavy socialization at a very, very early age.
And so can I ask
you,
Kathleen, do you think that this is some people say because of the fact that we are more advanced in civilized civilization that we no longer have these kind of constraints in the United States. I don't believe that's true. I believe that we are still subject to incredible prejudices against women, incredible racism against other nationalities, other creeds and colors of human beings. Do you think that's gotten better or improved in this day and age, or do you think not?
No, in fact, I think we see that racism and sexism are getting absolutely worse in this country.
I agree.
And that it's intensifying and accelerating, and that's so much in the context of war. But let us not be fooled to think that this country is more civilized than other countries in the world. I've been in a lot of countries.
Did you hear me say that? I'm the first one that says, you know, I don't care what you do, but please don't call yourself more civilized than other nations, because we
right.
still
and
have
I think
will.
That's what I think that's what you're pointing out. But you're hitting on something that's really it's endemic in this society. You hear it in the news all the time. Here, Obama, as soon as he's elected, talking about the United States having the best workers in the world, the best whatever in the world. You know, it's embarrassing, to say the least, when I hear that. But I want to come back to this question that you raised about what do we do about it. You see, I brought up the thing about socialization because I think that that this is where the remaking men, my book being Unmaking War, Remaking Men, this is where the remaking men begins. It also is that I think we cannot simply turn around and say these soldiers were simply brainwashed, therefore not responsible for what they've done. Because that then is virtually a license to kill. Some people, when faced with having to kill other people in combat, will turn away and say, no, I won't do this anymore. There's a sense of responsibility that people take on. I think they're the ones that we have to turn into our heroes, so that the others who go on and do the killing and later find their lives ruined because they did that, that they have different kind of heroes to look up to. If we looked up to the resistors, to the people that Courage to Resist, the organization Courage to Resist, defends and supports, if we make them our heroes, we have a new model of manhood, of masculinity, and a sense of very strong responsibility for one's actions. You see this very clearly in soldiers who are coming back and realizing what they did and feeling that they have to do something by way of fighting against the war or whatever other strategies they take on to address and make amends for what they did do. And I think that's really important, that we can't, you know, wipe the scales clean because brainwashing took place, because there's still people who've been able to walk away, and they are truly our heroes.
Absolutely. And people like Aaron Watada, Lieutenant Aaron Watada, who walked away and took it like a man. And he has been on our show. He's an incredible young man, someone that we can all admire. How do women, there's a number of questions that I have for you. One of them is from one of our guests, Dreema in Iowa, wants to ask you, Kathleen, what does Kathleen think of women still being allowed combat positions in the military?
Officially, women are not allowed combat positions in the military. In reality, women are sent into women soldiers, U.S. women soldiers who are in combat zones on other missions are very frequently used in combat. And find themselves, I mean, some of them have done very heroic things in combat and have been awarded, medals for conduct and things like that. But they also, they're in really a double jeopardy situation, because they also are being subjected to the dehumanization that is expected of soldiers to kill. There were women in Fallujah, in the terrible, horrendous battle in Fallujah, and they were subjected to that dehumanization that is the result of what they have done to Iraqi people, or Afghan people, at the same time that they are subject to sexual harassment, rape, and rape murder from the male soldiers that they're fighting with.
Yeah.
So their situation is the most difficult, the most vile in terms of a military situation. Slowly, this is starting to come to light. The military has done everything it could to keep a lid on this, including reprimanding women who have pressed charges for sexual harassment or rape against fellow soldiers, and done, you know, very much punished them, for this. So they are in a really, really difficult situation. And again, I think about how likely it is that they did not, that most of them did not expect to have their fellow soldiers turn on them the way they do, not to mention that they would also be turned into killing machines.
How are women affected differently when they return home, Kathleen? Do you have any research or data on that?
Well, you know, the post-traumatic stress disorder is something that women soldiers are very much subject to when they return home. Women soldiers who have been in combat zones, and especially then those who are actually fighting in combat, because there's a number of them in combat zones who are driving trucks, who are support staff to the fighting, who actually don't fight in combat. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, they have the trauma. A huge majority, not a huge majority, but a huge number of them have the trauma of the sexual abuse to deal with when they get home. It's very, very painful. And women in military anti-war organizations are acting on that and taking up these issues. Women in Iraq, Veterans Against the War, there's a network of women, its acronym is SWAN, that is dealing with this problem with women soldiers returning.
It is a phenomena that we have talked about often on this show. It's a triple whammy, because the women come back, they are afflicted by the post-traumatic stress, they're afflicted by the inhumane actions of some fellow soldiers, and some are assaulted and raped, as you said, and when they come back here, they're not even a lot, they don't even have any kind of services for them to,
right,
to, so that they can heal from all
then
of
they,
these
Then
atrocities.
They face the sexism of the Veterans Administration.
Exactly. It's over and over. It just is one assault on top of another. To be
right.
quite honest with you, I never did quite understand why women want to do this, but that's a whole other topic. We have another question from Mike in California. Mike asks, does your guest feel sorry for those soldiers now facing charges of war atrocities and murder in Afghanistan for murdering and taking body parts souvenirs of civilians? What would she suggest be done with them?
I think that the trial has to go forward. And at the same time, obviously they need treatment. The question for me in this case is whether the treatment would actually work for them, because the things that they did are the things that sociopaths do. It's not only doing these things without remorse, but actually enjoying and reveling in it. Now, this cult of enjoying and reveling in the ugliness and misery of killing and torture is on one hand expected of them. On the other hand, if soldiers have a predilection toward sociopathic behavior going into the military, then it is going to be really heightened. I think we are obligated in every case where murder can be established to take legal action, but to be very careful to make sure that these cases are not treated as the exceptional cases.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going on with this case, being treated as if what these guys did was really exceptional, as if the rest of the military, you know, are clean, you know, folding their napkins neatly after dinner and then sitting and, you know, reading.
I often think to myself, Kathleen, that is the one thing that I've never been able to reconcile. You know, when you tell people, well, this is what we've heard, or this is what we've listened to as interviews on our show oftentimes, and they'll say, well, that isn't everybody. Well, yeah, I'm not suggesting that it is every single person, but the propensity for outrageous violence, the propensity for sociopathic behavior, it doesn't start just when you go on there. We have some sick puppies that are going into, they are oftentimes people that couldn't find a job to save their souls. Retired General Wesley Clark has started a group that is dealing with the effects of what he perceives as the worst threat to our public security, and that is that we can't get anybody to pass the test, that they either they're not intelligent enough to pass the written test, they're too fat, or they're drug addicted, or they have a history of being incarcerated. So we can't even find healthy, normal people to put into the military anymore. So that, you know, it defies logic to think that everybody that goes into the military is rational or sane or doesn't have sociopathic tendencies.
Right.
You know, they're people just like everybody else.
Yeah. And so you're going to see that come out. But if they don't have psychopathic tendencies, as I've discussed in the book, they are expected to behave as if they are sociopaths in the military. Remorseless killing, killing for the fun of it, and having no feeling about that. Doing it and going on to the base and, you know, having a few beers and a few laughs with your buddies is everyday activity. And if we took it out of the military and put it in our society, we would want to lock those people up.
Well, unfortunately, isn't that exactly what we're doing? We're taking these people back and embracing them within our society. What are the possible ramifications and aftermath of having literally hundreds of thousands of soldiers that are returning vets that eventually, if they don't die there, will end up here within our society? How are they going to interact with normal society?
Well, we've seen this. This has been going on now for decades because we have a whole generation of men in particular from the Vietnam War who, where post-traumatic stress disorder was not even a diagnosis and treatment for that was considered unmanly. So we have a whole generation of, men walking around really wounded from that and many of them doing damage. I have a neighbor like that and it's been very, very difficult, living situation and dangerous.
I can imagine. I can imagine.
But we see it all over with these we have generations of these veterans who, you know, become a danger to the society around them. Not all of them, not all veterans. I know some really incredible veterans who are doing brilliant work, both anti-war work and counseling with veterans who are coming out of the military now and really doing wonderful, compassionate, empathetic work in helping these young people come back and have lives, get their lives together. So it's, we don't want to paint it as if it's, you know,
a broad, brush.
All one yeah. way, but it certainly is something that we have to, deal with.
Well, I have a feeling that our society is going to be forced to deal with things that we would ordinarily not have to deal with in war. You know, I have to tell you this, brief story. I was driving to work one day, and I listened to talk radio in the morning, and there was, it was a Christian, radio show that I was listening to. Well, the guy is Christian. I'm not going to place the blame on Christianity on this one, but this was so fascinating. He was a Christian sniper that had just returned from Afghanistan, and he was talking and how proud he was that he only shot terrorists. And the interviewer asked him, he says, well, I mean, how did you tell? He says, well, I have to admit it was kind of hard to tell if they were a terrorist or not since none of them were wearing uniforms. And he went on and glossed over it as if that was it. You know, it was kind of hard, but he knew and he was committed, and that he felt that he was justified and that he would not be hindered into going into heaven, because he only shot terrorists. How do people convince themselves of that crap?
Well, again, that's the...
I mean, I just... It is total lunacy. Hello? I guess we must have lost our guest, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be off back in just 1 minute. This is a good time to take a break.
Forever Fresh Disposable Undergarments offers a convenient, economic option to men and women who suffer from minor incontinence. Forever Fresh is a patented, internationally award-winning brand that allows the skin to breathe as naturally and comfortably as cotton garments. Environmentally friendly and hypoallergenic, the undergarment features a built-in incontinent pad pocket to be used when extra absorbency is needed. Forever Fresh is available at participating Walgreens. To learn more, you may also visit foreverfresh.com.
This land is your land. This land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us. But for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes. All are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio Show, and our guest tonight is Kathleen Berry, the brilliant author of Unmaking War and Remaking Men. We have had we're having a wonderful discussion here. It's fascinating, Kathleen. How do you survive writing and doing the research for this kind of work?
You know, my first book was called Female Sexual Slavery, and it launched a movement against trafficking in human beings. Mm-hmm. And I was asked the same question when I wrote that book. And I think what makes me write these books, as well as survive doing them, is that I really have the optimism, and the evidence for the optimism that change can take place. What makes me really pessimistic and very, filled with pain is to listen to the discussions that assume that, well, it's terrible that these things are going on, but that's the way it is, and there's nothing that we can do about it. I think having the optimism and the real understanding that change can take place, and that this book can be one of the elements toward making that change, fires my energy. I'm a feminist. I came out of the 60s, out of consciousness raising groups. I saw the city I lived in, grew up in, Syracuse, New York, desegregated by the work that we did in the early 60s in the civil rights movement. I've been to Vietnam to see the effects of what the movement here had on the war that we did against the Vietnamese. And all of these things have given me the basis for seeing change and realizing that we can all be part of it, and but we have to choose to do that. You know, have to choose to do it. You have to do
absolutely it. Because of the broadness of your outreach into the communities. Can you talk just very briefly about the United Nations and your work with female sex slavery and trafficking?
The United Nations is a big problem, but it's the only game in town at the moment until we can revamp that or replace it. When female sexual slavery was published, it really, or even human rights organizations were telling me at the time, oh, that doesn't exist. That was a 19th century problem, if it even existed at all. And I persisted with the book and realized that the international community had a much larger understanding of this issue than I was finding in this country. And the issue is indeed international. And so I took it to the United Nations, both to the Human Rights Commission and then to creating a feminist coalition of organizations around the world that are addressing trafficking in human beings, was called at that time Trafficking in Women. And so I established the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women as a human rights organization. It has official human rights organization status as a non-governmental organization of the United Nations, allowing the organization then to bring issues before the United Nations committees and represent the issue. The organization, I think, is in its 20 or 25th year. I resigned at one point as director because I had spent 3 decades in working on the issue and fighting it and pushing to get it to become visible. And after that amount of time, it was really time to have others take over, and it's still going.
Oh, that's wonderful. And bravo, congratulations. A much needed legislation. Can I ask you about your book tour? How is that going, and where are you going to be in the next weeks?
Thank you for the question. I'm going to be in New York City from April 4th to the 11th, and going to be speaking at Revolution Books on Monday the 4th, at Blue Stocking Bookstore on Friday the 8th, at Queens College, John Jay College, Pace University, and a number of other spots. I have all the events that have been confirmed are on the website for this book, and I'd like to give the listeners that website because there's a lot of other material about this book.
Oh, please do.
Website. It's www.unmakingwar.net. So it's kind of easy to remember.
That's unmaking war, not making war.
Right. Unmaking is what we're about.
Unmaking is the key word here.
That's the operative term. And so there's an events section on the website that lists where I'm going to be. I've also, as a result of questions that have come up when I have been out talking on this book, questions about how do we get from empathy to action, because as you know, the subtitle of the book is How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. And to me, it is kind of an automatic thing that when you engage in empathy, you do something. That it's not a thought or a value, it's an action. But it has been stumping. It stumped a bunch of people, and it's led me to developing a new workshop, which I'm offering in different places, and that's on my website, but I'm also hoping to be able to book it in different places, and that is called Unmaking War Now, From Empathy to Action, which can be either a half-day or a full-day workshop.
Sounds fascinating. And I can see why people, you know, I, on a personal journey myself, as an activist for many, many years now, I can't not take action. I don't know how to separate
the
two. So for me, it's like you said, you know, even this radio show came from a place of what we felt was inaction. We were arguing amongst ourselves, and then we said one day, why don't we get somebody to yell at instead of yelling at each other? So, and from there, this show started to develop. Now, it is important. It's vitally important for people to take action. But oftentimes, and I think that it's wonderful that you've created a workshop for this, Kathleen, because I don't think people know how. I mean, for me, it comes naturally. For you, I'm positive it comes naturally.
Right.
I think maybe it has something to do with the growing up during that 60s era where people took action. You became the product of your own making.
Yeah. I mean, there's a problem, you do something about it.
Exactly.
There's a war, you go after it. There's, you know, there's a racist
issue, you defend against
you,
it.
I'd like to pick up on what you're talking about with the radio program, because that is an action. In and of itself, it's an action. And you're influencing a whole lot of people in getting them thinking about or confirming their own thoughts about war. This workshop is aimed at orienting people toward creating actions that they would like to do, not recruiting people for a specific organization, but getting people to where we came from in consciousness raising, where you begin to see how power structures things around you. And when you see it, you've got to do something about it. You have that kind of aha moment. And what we did back in the 60s, and particularly in the women's movement, I think, was we created our actions as we went along, you know, and we, and I'm wanting to convey that and bring that to this workshop. At least 60% of Americans are against the war. Some figures go even higher, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. If we could mobilize a significant proportion of that 60% of the people who say, I'm only one person, what can I really do? Or, you know, I don't like that particular group, I don't want to be part of that particular action. Oh, but there's so many other things that you can do. You know, for one thing, keep Barack Obama's phone number and email
and
next
keep
to your...
calling him and emailing him and telling him to stop this insane war on now on Libya. It's like, oh, my
right.
God.
It's really important to see action from that phone call, your radio programs, Code Pink's actions out on the streets, the Iraq veterans against the war, individuals forming in small groups. In our community, we have a group of women in black who stand on the same street corner every Friday at noon.
All over here, they're in the market downtown in Detroit. I'm afraid we're going to have to call it a night, Kathleen. www.kathleenberry.net is her other site. Please, the book is Unmaking War and Remaking Men, How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. Get the book. It's a fascinating read. It helps empower you and it helps give you hope again. Thank you, Kathleen, for being our guest tonight. Next week's guest is Thad Russell, journalist and author of The Renegade History of America, and it's going to be a rip-roaring time. He's got some stories for you. Thank you very much, everyone, and thank you, Kathleen, for being our guest tonight.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate talking with you.
Thank you, and let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.